This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020.
Welcome to EMS 2020. This episode of 2020 brought to you by Pelican Headache Water.
What? Oh, nice.
Have a nice evening with a pelican, followed closely by a horrible headache.
But I love pelican beer so much in the meantime, but you are not wrong. That shit, yeah.
And it's normally... Breaker.
That's where I'm at.
Breaker pelican is fucking amazing. But God damn it, if you have just one, there's a headache waiting for you. I don't know. Maybe it's the age of 30 that the headache waits for you, but it waits.
That has just been the hardest part about turning, like getting into my 30s is that, and I'm in my late 30s. I'm staring down 40 and it's not grand. And it's just like alcohol just gets worse.
It really does.
It says that you need more to feel drunk and the recovery is worse. Like it's a candle burning at both ends. You got to drink more to feel good about it, but you got to drink less to feel bad the next day. And so it's two things colliding into each other.
Drink less to avoid feeling bad. But exactly. Fear not. If you want to just get it all out of the way now, I'm sure they have the 22-ounce nausea headache water. And I bet you could probably find or make 40-ounce night sweat water.
I believe all these come with a side of morning poop.
Oh man. Yeah, oh, wow. I had myself a pelican breaker earlier this evening.
That's awesome.
So I'm waiting for the headache to creep in.
We have kind of a cool episode that we're doing today. And it's kind of a first. We actually have a last episode we started with listener questions as well. We're going to do that again today. But also, we had a lot of interaction from you guys about a 12 lead that Spencer threw up the other day. So last week, Spencer threw up. Back to Pelican.
I was waiting for the joke.
There it is.
There it is.
Yep, slowly creeping in. But it was awesome. And so we got a ton of interaction from you guys, and we're going to give you guys the answer to that 12 lead. But first... Spence, you mind if I go into the listener question this week?
Yeah. So apparently, a hard hit for a soft shell or cell.
Oof. You're nailing this. It's actually a soft touch for a hard hit. But
there we go. Never mind me deleting my the episode name from the episode notes.
And today's question, by the way, comes from like all of you guys. So we got a ton of interaction on that. So in a soft touch for a hard hit, what ends up happening is we have an intoxicated patient who cracks their noggin and comes up altered. And the paramedics have to make that decision. Do I take her to a level one trauma center, which is farther away, the one she doesn't want to go to, or level two? She is pretty altered for the paramedics, and she's not really reasonable. And she's kind of irate, and they spend a lot of time like trying to do the whole like, you know, like getting her on her side. And they do some pretty good stuff. They end up kind of overselling it, which kind of makes her mad. But ultimately, we had a lot of you guys comment and come back to us and say like, hey, I would have taken her to the level two, because what ended up happening was they ended up taking her to a level one and she flipped out. And so they had to sedate and intubate her, correct?
Well, they intubated her at the hospital.
Okay.
The crew sedated her for the transport, but then they were able to monitor vitals and you know, establish IVs and do all the things that probably would have needed to happen anyway. There were some people going like, you know, there are risks inherent with having to sedate somebody, and there are risks with intubation.
Absolutely.
That had to happen at the hospital. And we don't know if she'd gone to the level two, if those things would have had to happen. I kind of assume they would have given how the patient sort of acted once they were in the ambulance and that nobody was allowed to touch the patient. You know, like the hippopotamus didn't have that rapport anymore. She basically was like, I'm here, but I don't want to be here. Like everything about her sort of said, nope.
So the big, so to me, like the big deciding factor is this, these are the two choices. You can take her to a level one, and the advantage of taking her to a level one is that if she does have a substantial head injury, she's at the right place. The disadvantage of taking her to a level one is that she is definitely going to freak out about it. She has shown a lot of signs at this point of instability and just not being really reasonable. And you would have every reason to believe the moment. And they did. Like, they anticipated this in that call when they told her, like, they're like, oh, shit. Yep. Like, we are going to pull the pin on this grenade. They knew that was coming. And yep. So that is both the advantages and disadvantages of the level one. The level two, the advantage to the level two is that you may get a more cooperative patient out of that. She seemed more willing to go to that hospital. It was kind of what she was expecting. And so that is one of the benefits. You may not have to sedate her, and she may not have to get intubated when she gets to the hospital. The disadvantage, of course, is if she does have a large head bleed or substantial intracranial injury, she might have to get transferred out. All right. So here's kind of my reason why I would say go to the level one. And that is that the advantages from my perspective, and these are the points that you guys brought up. Obviously, let us know if there's another point there. The advantages of the level two, to me, are not guaranteed in the sense that this patient's already shown that she can be unreasonable and unpredictable. So whereas she may seem amicable to going to the level two now, who knows how she's going to feel about it when she gets there?
Oh, that's good.
And so that's kind of my problem. So my problem is if I'm taking her to the level two for the advantage of, hey, I probably won't have to sedate and fight this patient, and they can probably take care of what she has going on, none of those advantages are guaranteed. And that's kind of my problem with it. With the level one, the main advantage that is guaranteed is that they have a higher level of capability. That's there no matter what I do, no matter what, how this patient responds. She's going to a hospital that can take care of her. The disadvantage is something that could occur also at the level two. So for me, that's kind of where my decision-making is if I took her to the level two and they had to sedate an intubator, then I've gained zero things. If I take her to the level one and I have to sedate an intubator, well, we lost on the sedate and intubation, but I've gained at least one thing. So to me, taking her to the level one, you're guaranteed to get one positive out of it versus the level two, you're not guaranteed to get a positive out of it. That's my decision making.
No, and that makes a ton of sense to me. And I will say, like, I know there are some systems out there that, you know, like the level two is the trauma facility, or the level three hospital is the trauma facility, you know, or however it's kind of divided out. I think, you know, in those situations, in those systems, like, then, you know, like, let your conscience be your guide. As to, you know, like taking the patient, you know, to try and do the most good for the patient. In this system, if hippopotamus had gone to the level two and it had turned into a massive, you know, like it turned into what they feared, which is that, you know, there might be a head bleed going on, that hospital probably would have been pretty unhappy. That would have been a QA flag, and it would have been a significant review from the agency as to why they didn't take the, you know, in retrospect, clearly head injured patient
right
to the appropriate trauma facility.
Yeah. In retrospect, clearly head injured patient.
In retrospect.
Yeah.
I think that's where I kind of get, I think, a little defensive for Le Hippopotama.
Yeah. There you go. Le Hippopotama. I didn't know it was a French hippopotamus. But... Yeah. Now, I do want to be clear, though, for a lot of for a lot of you guys who said that you would take them to the level two because you feel that's probably appropriate, I agree. My paramedic spidey sense is that this person's not really that head injured. And the level two is like 9 out of 10 cases. The level two is going to be just fine. But we've made a podcast out of the 1 out of 10. So it's kind of hard for me to vouch for, you know, it's kind of hard for me to kind of vouch for that, that technique based on that. But just so it's, yeah, I want you guys to know that, like, I absolutely see where you're coming from. And quite frankly, I can see myself being in the field, being like, man, let's just go across the street and then doing it. And then like doing this podcast later, being like, well, I got lucky. You know, like it's like, I will say I'm a better paramedic on this podcast than I probably am in the field. But, but that being said, God, Spence, let's get to the call.
Okay. Yeah. So this is a super cool call. And
super cool for nerds who like 12 leads.
Nerd. that's fairly true. But from a lot of people's response, they also happen to like 12 leads.
That's so true.
Here we go. Here's the call. EMS is dispatched to a 62-year-old male reportedly having chest pain. The location of this call is at the patient's private residence, and it's around 2300 hours. But let's put a pin in this dude's chest pain for just a moment.
Okay.
Which actually probably wouldn't help his chest pain. And quickly take a gander at the EMS system in which this dude's chest pain is occurring. This call takes place in a setting where several volunteer fire agencies cover a large response area and provide first response and BLS medical transport for calls. Many of the volunteers have their own jump kits and often respond directly to a scene from their home, typically within like 5 minutes, while other responders in their service will go and like fetch the fire ambulance and head to the scene. Now, at the same time a fire department is tapped, one of three private ambulance companies will also be dispatched to the call location, and their response time can vary from super short to 30 plus minutes.
Wow, okay.
So usually what happens in this system is the BLS provider will arrive, and they can either cancel the ALS private ambulance response and do a BLS transport once their own ambulance arrives to the scene, or they can wait for the private ambulance to respond, and then the arriving medic will get out of their ambulance and ride in with the fire ambulance providing ALS care. Or they can just quickly load the patient. The BLS provider can quickly load the patient on these like critical calls and drive to do an ALS intercept.
Yeah. And so, and just so you guys know, like normally, like oftentimes Spencer and I are bringing each other calls and the other person's blind. Spencer and I actually both interviewed the person who gave us this call together. So we are, can't fail because I already know what's going to happen.
We already know.
Yeah.
There's neither of us killed the patient this week. Yes. All right.
Woot woot.
So there are also several hospitals in this region. There's two major hospitals and a couple of, we'll just call them like lower tier hospitals. Lower tier in that they don't have some of the major services that the larger ones do. Specifically in this call, we're referring to like a cath lab. So one of the lower tier hospitals happens to be the closest to where this patient resides. So this call comes to us from Underdog, who has been an EMT and volunteer firefighter for about a decade. On this late evening, they respond directly from their own home to the home of our patient, Mr. Redacted.
Ooh.
I know, right? Sounds CIA-ish.
Wouldn't that be hilarious if that was your actual name, Mr. Redacted? It's like, can someone just say his name? No, that is his name. Like, why is it redacted? Is this... This is a raffle. We don't need to worry about that kind of protection. Someone just tell him he won the Sonicare toothbrush and move on. We should know who he is.
Right? Yeah, that would suck if you like actually like you put your name in for one of the you know like the those you know car things that
but
you
nobody
can, like at Costco, you know, they're like, you can win this car, you know, drop your name and it's like Mr. Redacted. They're like, well, fuck.
Just I go guess to the
we
next
have to
one.
Draw again.
Yeah. God dang it. I would get my last name changed.
Right. All right. So Underdog responds, but one of their fellow responders beat them to the scene, and another had gone to grab the ambulance before heading to the scene. So while this might seem kind of like a strange system, actually a lot of systems kind of have this, where like there might be like a fast response unit or a first response unit, where it's basically just like a medic or an EMT that sort of just shows up to respond to scenes first. And often that stops the timer on calls, depending on like the system that you are operating in, because usually there is a response time for agencies to respond to calls with.
And I think that's a good point to bring up. Do you mind if I go on a little bit of a systems breach? This is kind of my EMS thing, is I'm very familiar with different EMS systems and why they exist and those kind of things and why things are done that way. One of the things that people have to keep in mind is that there's a lot of emphasis or emphasis on sorry. That's a, that is a nerdy language joke. And so, but anyway, but there's a lot of emphasis on getting there in 8.5 minutes or getting there in 11 minutes, you know, getting there in some sort of certain time frame. But one of the things that we have to understand is that oftentimes when we get on scene, what do we do when we get on scene? We don't start transporting right away, except for in all but the most rarest cases. We sit on scene for a bit, for usually at least 10 minutes, oftentimes much more than that. So it makes sense to have these kind of systems, especially when you don't have the resources that like maybe a larger city or an area that's more saturated with paramedics would have. It makes sense to have systems where first responders that can get there quick, but maybe not transport, can get there and start doing some of the stuff that's going to take place in that 10 minute, 15, 20 minute on scene time anyway. So by the time the transporting unit comes up, the transporting unit only stays on scene for a couple minutes and then bolts, and then that's it. So you guys got to understand that just because an ambulance shows up on scene does not mean they're going to transport right away. So these systems do make sense. They seem weird and awkward, but there is a rhyme and reason to them. I mean, sometimes they don't make sense, but anyway, that's why it's done. So that's why you got to kind of keep that in mind. I'm sorry for the derailment there. Go ahead.
No. And I think that's a really good point to bring up. And like, there are definitely some calls where you kind of want a first, like you want somebody who's like CPR trained to show up to the CPR call, like away.
Yeah.
Because early CPR, good CPR makes a difference. And, some of the citizens, don't like to do CPR
or they just don't know how.
Terrible at it. Yep.
I mean, it's CPR is harder than you think, especially like when you get these elderly patients where the person doing CPR is their elderly spouse. You know, it's just not going to be great compressions.
Yeah.
Then we're breaking ribs of their patient and then their own hips.
Right. So. And then you have a double code.
Nah, dun, dun, dun. Listen to that episode.
Right. Yeah, that was a good episode. All right. So anyway, Underdog is on his way to the call. He has a jump kit with BLS supplies, including an AED, EMT medications, C-collars, etc. So Underdog arrives to find Mr. Redacted sitting on the couch with his wife and daughter at his side. He arrives shortly after another volunteer responder who had actually performed an initial assessment and started to gather some of the history of present illness. That assessment, by the way, is that we have an alert and oriented male who appears slightly pale, but otherwise is acting very normal. So the HBI that is gathered is this. The patient reports that he had had some right-sided chest pain for about 2 hours on and off, but that it's nothing like it is now, and it's currently an 8 out of 10 pressure. This all started while he was sitting on the couch. The patient is noted to not be diaphoretic at this time, but they did say that they were very sweaty earlier. Mm-hmm. The patient denies any nausea, denies shortness of breath, denies lightheadedness. While asking the HPI questions, Underdog starts in on a set of vitals and finds the heart rate is 64 and regular. Blood pressure is 180 over 108. Respirations are 16, non-labored, and the patient's 98% on room air. Lung sounds were also assessed and were noted to be diminished on the right side, but the patient did report that they had some significant scarring on their right lung from a motorcycle crash years and years and years back. Their medical history is hypertension, for which they take a prescription, but otherwise they have no history of heart.
There's an episode called History of Heart.
And we fucking hate the term history of heart. Anyway.
Oh, God, we do. History of heart, like, it's the most useless chunk of dispatch information. I personally find most dispatch information useless, and that's another rant for another time. But when I say, they have a history of heart, that could mean anything from hypertension to 17 stents placed. I don't know how you'd have 17 stents placed, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Your stents have stents. I think those would be called step stents. But anyway, all right. So allergies are confirmed and the patient is given 324 of aspirin orally. And then I'm trying to like, I guess we could give it another way, but orally makes sense. All right. And then they set about waiting
orally
for
orally is more customer service oriented, I feel. That's
very true. sir, you need this. Damn it.
Ma'am, look away.
Avert your eye.
No, don't avert Boom. That. We need that.
All right. Slight pressure. All right.
That is why you guys always carry so much lubricant in the ambulance. It's not for innovation.
It's really not. All right. So they give the gentleman aspirin orally, and then they set about waiting for their ambulance and the incoming
I'm going to disclaimer really quick. Just really quick. Don't shove aspirin up people's asses. And here's why. Besides the obvious, because here's my worry. I see someone sitting there and having just kind of a heck of a situation where like, God, the patient can't protect his airway. You know what? I listened to this podcast.
Oh, shit.
I got an idea. Let's just, here's the thing. Those things are enterically coated. All right. And your digestive system is like one giant one-way street. Okay. So when you swallow something, it's only going one direction typically, unless of course you have had a pelican headache water, in which case it may come the other way. But typically the patients that you guys are going to be walking in on it's going to be going one way. So aspirin is enterically coated, which means it is designed to go down that normal path. So if you go shoving it up someone's ass, I cannot tell you what will happen. It may work. It may not. Don't do it. Moving on.
All right. The opinions expressed by Spencer Oliver and Chris Fixter are not necessarily that of Good Medical Reason.
All right. We're not doctors. So
they set about waiting for the ambulance and the incoming paramedic to arrive at the scene. Now, interestingly enough, shortly after the aspirin is given, the patient's pain starts decreasing significantly. And now they're actually, the patient's very much disinterested in going to the hospital. And the patient is gently advised that they need to go to the hospital because they were having chest pain. But the patient does not want to go to the hospital, which has the cardiac services, because it's also the dedicated COVID-19 hospital.
And just so you guys know, this is something that has occurred to a lot of EMS providers, is that this kind of stuff makes the news. So patients have been very aware of what's been going on at the hospitals in regards to COVID-19. So this is not terribly unheard of.
The volunteer who beat Underdog there says, okay, well, how about we at least take you to the closest hospital? And the family joins in kind of convincing the patient that they really do need to go.
Good.
So while that conversation is going down, all the necessary players arrive at the scene. The fire department lieutenant arrives with the ambulance, and the private ambulance medic, Droopy Dog, also arrives at the scene and makes their way in. Now, Underdog has worked with Droopy before and recognizes them. Droopy is not known for being the most friendly medic, but is otherwise described as a very good paramedic.
I love his nickname.
Droopy. But Droopy Dog appears very disinterested in this patient. Mm-hmm. So report is given, and Droopy is described as acting very aloof towards the patient. My interpretation of this description is basically like, I'm just unimpressed by the chest pain. That's like, oh, the pain's gone after the aspirin, and he doesn't look sweaty, and like, okay. And it's right-sided chest. Okay, fine. Like, sure.
And I think that generally kind of comes from there's kind of a perception out there that, well, and this is true, like, aspirin rarely has an acute effect. So a lot of times, if you give a patient aspirin and they improve, a lot of paramedics would be like, look, that's more likely placebo and nothing was wrong in the first place than to actually have a positive impact from the aspirin. So That's where I feel that comes from. I don't know Droopy. I've never worked with the guy. But that's my thoughts.
I have seen this sort of behavior, and I have probably exhibited this sort of behavior.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah. So this would be my interpretation based on my own experience. So when the subject of transport and destination comes up, Droopy says, "It's fine. We can take him to the closest one." I'm going to put a pin right here real quick just to point out that up until this point, the only thing that's happened is vitals have been taken and aspirin has been given. Okay.
That gotcha. Vitals taken, aspirin given, boom.
And it's been determined that they can go to the closest hospital. All right. So the fire department lieutenant who brought the ambulance to the scene then starts to ask if they should bring up the stretcher, but they are cut off mid-sentence by Droopy, who says they, meaning the patient, can walk out to the ambulance. Once in the fire ambulance, Underdog hops in with Droopy. The patient reports that they are completely pain-free at this point.
Nice.
Their vitals are BP 167 over 100 with a heart rate of 70. Respirations are normal. The patient is then put on a 3-lead cardiac monitor, and then a 12-lead is performed, neither of which seem to alarm Droopy in the slightest. Now, to the listeners who got on our Facebook and saw the copy of the 12-lead, you have an advantage at this point to the people who haven't, in that you've seen the 12-lead, and you know your own opinion on it. There we go. We'll come back to that later. All right. The patient is transported for 26 minutes to the nearest hospital. They were described as calm and stable. One more set of vitals is taken, which basically are the same, and a snapshot of the 3-lead rhythm is captured for the chart. Underdog stayed near the patient for the transport, trying to make pleasant conversation, while Droopy sat, arms crossed, looking at the ceiling. About 10 minutes out from the destination hospital, the hospital's notified of their impending arrival via an app, and about 5 minutes out, Droopy takes the patient off the monitor and just starts packing everything away.
So Droopy's kind of checked out.
Yeah, I'd say that seems to be the case. That he's decided that none of this is really alarming. And, you know, like, to his credit, the patient's sitting there calm, the patient's pain-free. There was nothing that he saw that was alarming on the 12-lead, so, yeah. What are we doing? All right. So on arrival to the ED, the patient is wheeled into a room, and before Droopy and Underdog clear to go back into service, the facility is calling to transport to arrange a STEMI transfer, and the staff approach Underdog and Droopy to let them know that the patient that they brought in is in fact a STEMI patient.
Yeah, when we were doing this call, there was a part of me that really loved hearing that.
Yeah. Well, so
there's a lot to unpack.
There really is a lot to unpack. And here's the thing, guys, I won't lie. This call kind of makes me a little mad.
12-lead man.
Here's the good news. This is what makes me feel better, is that almost everybody who responded and messaged us on our Facebook basically said the same thing, which was or some variation of the same thing, which is like, this is alarming.
Yeah.
I think there is something going on here. I don't think this is a STEMI necessarily, but there is something, there is some kind of, you know, pathology that is occurring
now,
and they need to go to a hospital, preferably one with a cardiac cath lab.
Also, however, in defense of Droopy, obviously, if our show is basically a show about reviewing mistakes and we put up a 12 lead, that's kind of a hint that maybe you should look close. But
that's true.
You know, so it's a little bit different context. So, but what kind of, and I'm kind of in with Spencer's agitation here, is kind of what I saw happen here is that the paramedic put a lot of weight on you know, just kind of those soft judgment values, just that four-year paramedic stuff that we talk about. And here's the thing. It sounds like this paramedic is usually a pretty good paramedic. So I don't want anyone to try and like say this is a bad paramedic. This is just a bad call that they ran. And we all have those. And if you haven't had one yet, here's the thing. If you've been in this industry any amount of time, you have an EMS 2020 call somewhere in your repertoire. It will happen. I have them. You will have them sooner or later too. So
yeah.
So it's kind of one of those things where like, I'll defend him a little bit there, but the thing that kind of irks me though, is he really went off the, oh, he was given aspirin and that's what cured his chest pain. It's probably not really cardiac. He says he's fine now. Mm-hmm. And he kind of did what comes natural at that point is he sort of rejected evidence, or at least he didn't really look. So,
yeah,
that's kind of my irritation with it.
So I guess, why don't we hit it in kind of chronological order? So I think there was a great assessment done to start with. I think that the BLS crew came in, they got the important things out of the history that needed to be gotten. They prioritized getting aspirin on board, and essentially they were kind of in a holding pattern waiting for the paramedic to show up so that they could do the paramedic and the ambulance to show up so they could kind of continue care.
And they were actually a very good example of why these types of systems exist, where it's more about getting a responder on scene than getting them transported ASAP.
Yeah. And there were some irregularities in this gentleman's chest pain. We often don't hear of right-sided chest pain and associate that with like, a cardiac problem. Side note, we should, because sometimes that is the case, and oftentimes it's actually a more significant injury when that is the case. But it's still kind of, it's not a typical chest pain sort of complaint. Now, of course, the 8 out of 10 pressure is, again, there's some irregularities there. And then the significant irregularity is that the pain lessened shortly after the aspirin. And I have some possible explanations for that I'll go into later. But where things went wrong is where I think the paramedic showed up and made that snap judgment that this patient wasn't sick without any of the information really to support that assertion. He hadn't done a 12 lead. He hadn't even put the patient on a monitor at that point. And he's saying without really any good reason that the patient can go to the non-cath, like the hospital without the cath lab, without any real good reason to say that.
With no evidence.
And maybe there's that, he's operating on that sort of like gut intuition, but you can have that gut intuition because everybody does, but you need to back that up. You need to go like, all right, I want to make sure that I'm not wrong. Because remember, our job isn't to identify what's wrong. It's to identify life threats and make sure we're not missing any of those.
Right.
So here's the good news is that I think that this is a sort of a reckless move by this paramedic. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's, he's not purposely like, you know what? I fucking hate this guy and I want him to die. he's not going there going like, oh, this guy owes me. Mr. Redacted, we finally meet. You owed me money. And this is my opportunity to murder you. Oh, I see the STEMI and I just don't care.
No,
like,
this is...
all his behavior just sort of indicates that there's like a lack of, I think a lack of knowledge.
So this is more manslaughter than murder.
Exactly. This is a perfect example. Yeah. This is gotcha. More manslaughter. Like it was an accident. If I had known better. And here's the thing though. And this is why it still is manslaughter and not just like, oh man, who could have known that this would have happened?
Did this patient die?
I don't know that. I know that they were transferred as a STEMI and went to the cath lab.
Anytime someone goes to a cath lab, there's potential to die. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So maybe Mr. Redacted is dead. Mr. Didacted. dead. Yeah.
Now he's sorry, Mr. Departed.
Mr. Departed. Jesus. There we go. The knowledge piece is like it's better that, this wasn't like some kind of intentional like, all right, fuck you, I don't care about your STEMI. But the 12 lead does have the information that the paramedic needed to see that there was something going on. And we can and we can quibble over whether or not it meets STEMI criteria or whether it should be called a STEMI, you know, a STEMI, because it isn't a traditional STEMI in some senses, but it very much is an occlusive, like indications of an occlusive MI. In my interpretation of this, this is a high lateral MI, in my opinion. And in my opinion, absolutely warranted a, like, hey, you need to go to this other hospital.
Right.
And it warranted, if not that, at least at the very minimum, repeat 12 leads being done during the transport.
I agree.
So, because, because if you do one 12 lead, you should plan on doing another in about 10 to 15 minutes because these things can change. And in fact, if your 12 lead does change, if you start getting larger T waves, if you start noticing more depression, see other signs of injury that are occurring, then that tells you that there is a dynamic injury process that is happening. And that that should alarm you, because your 12 lead shouldn't change in 15 minutes. You know, there aren't any mimics that will change in that course of time, save for like pericarditis or possibly hyperkalemia. But most of the standard mimics, like left ventricular hypertrophy, left bundle branch blocks, right bundle branch blocks, that, you know, those things like early repolarization, like those things don't change.
Right.
Whereas a STEMI definitely will. So we've kind of alluded to the 12 lead. I'm gonna do my best to kind of describe the 12 lead to everybody.
Really
recognizing,
quick.
Yeah.
Before we get there, I kind of want to make one more point about 12 leads and MIs and chest pain, if it's cool.
Yeah.
So yeah. It'd be really weird if you said it wasn't cool. Like if you're like, no.
Actually, you know what? I'm kind of digging my own voice right now. So.
Okay, cool. Well, hey, guess who edits these? Guess whose voice can be completely absent from the entire thing? Okay. I would never do that. I might change your voice one day for an episode. Who knows? Be Alvin and the Chipmunks. But one of the things that I actually want to point out, I mean, just like Spencer said, like 12 leads so often, and I've run calls like this, is I do a one and done 12 lead. You really shouldn't. If a patient has chest pain, a one and done 12 lead isn't necessarily the best idea. And I don't know exactly how to give advice to integrate this, but you should be doing repeat 12 leads. Because one of the things I want to tell you really quick is that chest pain comes from ischemia. So not all chest pain, but chest pain, when a heart becomes ischemic, that will cause chest pain. ST elevation and your markers on a 12 lead typically come from damage to the myocardium. So just because you have some ischemia going on does not necessarily mean you have reached that threshold of cellular damage to cause ST elevation. So it's entirely possible to have ischemia occurring and chest pain occurring, but not have ST elevation occur yet. But it certainly can down the road. So if someone is having cardiac symptoms and you do a one and done 12 lead that shows negative, that doesn't mean you're in the clear at all. It just means that at this juncture, if they are having an ischemic event, it has not caused enough cellular damage to create the ST elevation in the 12 lead. So that is something that I would like to just kind of point out there, that chest pain and ST elevation are not related. Chest pain is related to ischemia. ST elevation is related to cell damage. So
I also want to point out too that, and this probably actually is a reasonable explanation for why this patient suddenly stopped having chest pain or had kind of on and off chest pain over that course of time. So remember that just because something clots, you also have, you know, like cells in your body that are dedicated and enzymes that are dedicated to breaking down clots. And so you can actually have like, you're, you know, like we'll say 98% clotted or 95% clotted. And then like that one little, you know, red blood cell comes or, you know, whatever the platelet comes and sort of like sticks in the hole. And then something comes along and sort of breaks that down and allows blood to go through again, relieving that chest pain temporarily. You can also see this in an EKG. There are plenty of STEMI examples where somebody has what looks like an alarming EKG initially and then has a normal EKG and is chest pain, you know, is pain free and, you know, or has like subtle signs of a STEMI that even, you know, the ER physician missed. But then later develops that chest pain and in some cases, you know, goes into like a cardiac arrest. You know, hopefully they're in the ER when this happens. But I mean, that's one of the reasons that patients stay in the ER so long when they have chest pain. So that's probably, that could have been what happened here is that this patient's, you know, pain, like the clot broke down to allow enough blood to get through for them to kind of feel the relief of that, you know, from that ischemia. But they still had that injury, you know, happening in their heart. That was visible on this 12 lead and still very much needed to go to the cardiac catheter hospital. So, but we've kind of beat around the bush enough. I think we should probably talk about the 12 lead that we keep describing. sort of.
So here's the thing about that 12 lead. I gotta tell you guys this. So we actually had a really awesome conversation with the person who gave us this call and we ended up doing a Zoom meeting and they were able to show us a 12 lead there. And I squinted the 12 lead and I got to the mental, now I wear contacts, not glasses, but mentally I had gotten as far as how far I'd gotten in analyzing this 12 lead. I'd gotten to the mental equivalent of putting on your bifocals and staring down your nose to be like, okay, let's see what we have here before Spencer goes, that's a STEMI. I mean, it was literally like getting hit by a freight train. I'm like, well, fuck, he saw that quick. Spencer,
we didn't know the outcome at that time. I'll throw that out there too. Cause he's like, nothing. Yeah, so then we did the STEMI transfer and here's the 12 lead.
He just threw the 12 lead up. Like the guy just threw the 12 lead up and Spence goes, yeah, it's a STEMI. And he goes, well, that's interesting that you say that. And then he tells us the story. So we knew nothing about it. And so like Spencer's kind of modest. And so I'm going to say this for him. It was fucking incredible. There is a nurse that we both, fuck me. There is a nurse that we both work with that has said that you should have been an electrophysiologist because 12 leads is like your thing. Like you're just good at it. And it was super impressive. It is one of those things where I'm like, okay, either Spence just nailed this from the outfield. Like he just basically just fucking lit it up or he's about to be super embarrassed like one or the other, but he was right. And let's go over some of the responses we got from you guys. We got a lot of responses. We were so happy about that too. So Rain Libby Bradford, Rain went ahead and sent us their response, and they said that they would keep treating this patient as potential STEMI due to the amount of depression that was present. The depression is present in what leads again?
So on this EKG, we have a sinus Brady, technically, at about 55 beats per minute. There is depression in leads 2, 3, and AVF, more significant in 3 and AVF. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of elevation, maybe half a millimeter in AVL. There is nothing in lead 1. There is also maybe... saying a millimeter would be generous in V1 of elevation. Mm-hmm. There is also in V2, probably about one box, so 1 millimeter of elevation. And then everything else seems a little normal. There might be a little bit of subtle ST depression in V6, but I only say that given the rest of the 12 lead. If there were nothing else on there, it would be inconsequential. Nice. But with everything else on there, it now seems like it could be a little bit of ST depression.
Nice. So we also got a response. Let's see. Jeremiah Gerber said that it doesn't meet STEMI criteria, but that they would then transport code 1 to a cardiac capable facility due to no current pain or symptoms.
And I'll respond to that. I don't necessarily disagree. It doesn't meet traditional STEMI criteria.
Traditional right.
STEMI criteria is kind of garbage, though. I'll be the first to throw. I'll say that, and I'm not the only one who said that. There are experts way above our level who also say that. Because here's the thing, guys: there are plenty of things that will cause ST elevation. ST elevation has about a 15% accuracy in actually being a STEMI. There's so many things that cause ST elevation that are not dangerous, that are just
mine's
normal.
Just got blown, by the way, with that little factoid.
This was a study done in 2002, and they looked at all the ST elevation that came in and like at an ER, and then retrospectively just went like, okay, how much of this ended up actually being an MI? And it turned out to be actually not a lot at all. The other thing is there are things that are definitely MIs that don't present with ST elevation. Yeah. There's a condition called De Winter's T waves. I'm not going to bore everyone with it. I highly recommend you look it up. Recognize the pattern. Essentially, it's just they're large hyperacute T waves with ST depression. Those are absolutely indicative of an MI. And should be treated as a STEMI equivalent. And I think that's the thing that bothers me, is there are many things that are called STEMI equivalents because they don't meet the traditional STEMI criteria. And so then it sort of tells me that the traditional STEMI criteria
sucks.
Sort of sucks.
Sucks. And also, go ahead.
And a better way to review 12 leads is to get comfortable. Imagine them to be like, there are clues beyond ST elevation. There's ST depression. There's Q waves. There's poor R wave progression in the precordial leads. By the way, that plays in here because the R wave in V2 is actually less. It's just a Q wave in V2 instead of like an R wave, even that would be even the same in as in V1. So there's all these other things that can cue you in to the fact that there's an injury happening, along with the patient's complaints, along with the assessment, along with that history, that all make a better selling point for why you should treat this as an occlusive MI or as a STEMI. Mm-hmm.
Real quick.
Sorry.
I also want to do Jeremiah Gerber a little bit of justice here. He did also add to the end of the end of his response that I really like this, is that if symptoms returned or pain increased, they had upgraded code 3. And this is something that a lot of you guys said. He puts it very eloquently, and he says, also transmit that shit. What he means is
perfect. Yeah. Cause you know what? If you transmitted this, an ER physician would likely catch this. And that's only because, by the way, paramedics, it's been proven in studies, anybody who learns how to read a 12 lead can read a fucking 12 lead as good as doctors can. It's not that hard. Nice. It's really just pattern recognition. And I learned this because I came out into the field at terrible at 12 leads. And I came out and I was very like, oh man, I really don't feel comfortable with this. And a lot of old timers lied to me and said like, yeah, don't worry about it, man. Cause like the monitor will tell you, the monitor will fucking lie to you. It's Skynet. It's out to fuck you. It's the Matrix. It's trying to take over you and make
Agent
you
Smith.
Look like an asshole. Exactly. It's Agent Smith. It's like, all right, Mr. Anderson. You missed the STEMI.
Mr. Redacted.
Mr. Redacted. Yeah. And I learned very quickly, like, I needed to learn this stuff. And as I started to learn it, I started to become more comfortable with it. And then it actually became kind of interesting. And I just wanted to see how far the rabbit hole goes.
Yeah. So also just one more quick shout out to another listener, Kate Markham from across the pond. I just want to talk really briefly about Kate's treatment plan here. And I love it because it's a little bit different than what we do in the US here. But Kate drops, their response would be morphine, IV paracetamol, which is Tylenol, and clopidogrel. I can't pronounce the name.
Okay. Yeah, and that's basically like a it's sort of similar to aspirin.
Did I pronounce it right?
I believe you did.
Okay, perfect. I don't know.
And if you just edit it into a thing.
Anyway, and then ondansetron or Zofran is kind of what they usually do for MIs over there, which it's close in the sense of what each of those drugs do. I mean, morphine treats pain. It also vasodilates. We give nitro, which also vasodilates. Sometimes we'll give fentanyl on top of that, which is just another narcotic that's essentially like morphine, but a little more fine-tuned. IV Tylenol is a little bit new. I mean, that's something we definitely don't do here. And then we give aspirin as an antiplatelet aggregator. So it's just kind of, I just wanted to kind of throw that response out there just because I thought it was interesting. It's very different from the US.
And importantly, she also said that they would transmit, I believe.
Was that? Yep. Which, Kate definitely said that.
Which, you know, transmitting is a really good, like when I first, like I didn't like transmitting at first because I was like, no, we should learn this. But I, you know, I recognize like I'm an odd duck.
Yeah. Well, but also kind of one of the things like, so I hope I'm not bouncing too far off here. I love the ability to transmit, but I do agree with kind of your take. Like we got to learn this because here's the thing. Sometimes transmitting just doesn't work. And you may, and like you said, like when properly trained, we're just as good as an ER doc grabbing that and looking at it anyway. I think a lot of the STEMI criteria and the reason that I think they really need to be, I will tell you this, I ignore STEMI criteria in my day-to-day practice. Not, it isn't that I ignore ST elevation. I don't not do these things. Yeah, exactly. But I ignore it in the sense that I don't let it govern what I'm going to do. I've just learned to read 12 leads. Not as good as you, Spence, but still pretty good. Because my problem is I feel the STEMI criteria come from an age where it was assumed that paramedics just simply are not going to learn 12 leads to the extent that they need to. So they made simplified criteria that unfortunately don't catch all the STEMIs out there. I just don't think it's that good of a system because 12 leads are not as hard. I think it's kind of one of those things where paramedics for ages have been told, well, to really understand 12 leads is really, really hard. And you're just not, it's just out of your, just, you know, don't have ambition. It's just out of your reach to be able to do that.
Stay in your lane.
Paramedic. Exactly. But it's not, it's really, really not.
Listen, they fucking taught doves how to interpret like whether there's breast cancer available on mammograms.
Right.
The fucking higher degree. The fucking it was doves or pigeons. I don't know. Some avian bastard rat learned how to read fucking mammograms better than clinicians did to a higher degree. Like if fucking flying rats could learn that shit, like it's really possible. For if you,
it was probably
it,
you know,
it
doves.
Just takes practice.
It was probably doves. They can also make soap.
Oh, nice. Well done. Yeah. Well, that was a nice clean joke.
Oh, wow.
It's family friendly.
Oh, God. You know when a joke becomes a dad joke? When the punchline is apparent.
Oh, God damn it. Well done. Yeah. I think this is something, and by the way, there's data to back this up. There's a really good test. You can actually kind of check to see like how you compare in your interpretation of 12 leads. I'll post the link on our Facebook after this call pops up or this recording goes up, and everybody will get a chance to, if they want, interpret about 30 12 leads, and you can see how you compare to cardiologists, ER physicians, and other paramedics in terms of your accuracy. One other point I want to make on this 12 lead, and kind of again talking about that STEMI criteria, just because it doesn't necessarily meet it. Some people might argue like, well, there's no two contiguous leads, and you're right, there isn't. There's, you know, V2 and AVL. This is a high lateral MI, in my opinion, in my interpretation of this, because this is we have ST elevation in AVL, and it's not even a box. It's maybe half a millimeter. But a really good point to bring up is that it's the QRS complex is actually really small. And so ST elevation has to kind of be taken into context with the QRS. If the QRS is really tiny, then proportionally the ST segment off of that is actually rather massive.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Another thing I'd be remiss not to mention is the morphology of the ST elevation. That's the shape of the ST elevation. The shape here is a giveaway for injury. If there's going to be ST elevation that is a mimic, it often will have a concave appearance. Here, you don't see that. You see sort of an oblique or a flat top. In AVL, there's a flat top. In V2, there's just kind of a flat rise. Both those presentations are way more evidence towards occlusive MI. One of the other things I want to bring up specifically to ST elevation in 1 and AVL, or ST elevation in the inferior leads like 2, 3, and AVF, is that oftentimes the first sign of injury is ST depression in the reciprocal leads. And so if you look at a 12 lead and you see ST depression in 2, 3, and AVF, and even just a hint of elevation in AVL, that should make your alarm bells go off, that something might be happening, even if you don't have elevation in lead 1.
Mm-hmm. And what I would say are the big triggers for me on this one. Now, I'm going to admit, I got this one wrong in the sense that I didn't know. I told Spence, I'm like, you know, I would make this a STEMI activation, but I didn't have a good reason why. And here's where I failed. So the big things about this 12 lead that stood out to me were, like Spence said, the depression in 2-3 AVF. And those are inferior leads. And inferior leads are typically reciprocal to lateral MIs. And so I went ahead and looked at the I kind of started perusing from left to right. I saw ST elevation in V1 and V2. And I'm like, huh, well, that's a septal, like those are septal leads there. He's probably having some kind of MI here. Like, I've got some pretty contiguous reciprocal lead depression, and I've got some elevation over here. I'm like, well, let's go look at V5 and V6 because those are lateral leads, and that's where my reciprocal depression is. And I looked at V5 and V6 and saw nothing. And so while I was like, well, I think something's going on here. Like, I think he's having a STEMI, but I don't know where. I still would have said, hey, this is a STEMI call and gone and done a STEMI activation, which would have been code 3. But what I didn't catch was the ST elevation in AVL. And that is really where I should have been looking. And so that is what I would say, is that anytime you have substantial reciprocal depression in any leads, start looking at the leads they're reciprocal to. And then, like Spence said, the amount of ST elevation is really more relative to the QRS than anything else. And quite frankly, I would say the amount of ST elevation in terms of 1 box or 2 box, throw that out the window. If you have it, you have it. That's where I sit personally. Because you got to remember, as a paramedic, like I think we've touched on, my goal isn't to find out exactly where this STEMI is. My goal is to figure out, do I activate the cath lab or not? That's it. Yeah. I actually don't even have to figure out what it is. I have to figure out what I do about it. And so in this instance, I hear a lot of paramedics hear this all the time. It's only 1 box. Well, yeah. If it's 1 box in a lateral lead with reciprocal changes in inferior leads, what else do you think is causing that? If it's not a STEMI, then what is it? And the answer is, well, shit, it must be a STEMI then. Because there's really nothing else that's going to make that happen, right? I mean, there's very few things, I would say, that would make that happen. And even if there were things that would make that happen, err on the side of caution and make it a STEMI activation. Because worst case scenario, everyone just says, oh, shit, no, it's this weird cardiac parasite. I don't know. But, you know, yeah. that's where I'm at.
I think the other thing, too, and this is something we brought up earlier, is like if you looked at this 12 lead and you went, I'm just not sold yet, make sure you have the yet in there. Remember, you can do repeat 12 leads, and you should. You should do repeat 12 leads, Q10, Q15, you know, depending on the length of your transport. You should do that, and you should look for changes. You should look for those things. And that would be further evidence that might tip you off that, ah, shit, okay, something is actually going on. You know, I think a lot of people are like, I need to determine off of this 112 lead, like, this is sort of that paramedic mentality. Like, I have one chance to get this right. You don't. You have all the way to the fucking hospital to get it right. Like, you've got all that time. And so you can use it and you can absolutely reevaluate and go like, hey, you know what? I wasn't convinced earlier. I just did a repeat and it looks like, boy, that ST depression actually kind of got worse. And maybe there's a little more elevation, or maybe like a T wave looks bigger and kind of angrier. And then you go like, okay, shit, this is actually a STEMI now. Like, there's enough has changed and now I'm convinced. And you can adjust, and you should. And that would be you should get a fucking cookie for that. Well done.
I so, wish I had cookies at the ER.
That would be awesome, right? They'd be dry.
Yeah,
like Lorna still. Dune cookies.
But I need I like sand. They are dry. They are pretty much compressed sawdust, but and
they taste like it too.
No sawdust and sugar. But I like them though. I like them. And I know it's just me, but I like them. They're hospital prepackaged cookies. And here's the thing. I have never seen a Lorna Dune cookie in any other setting. Like, I've never been. There's no boxes of them at the grocery store. They're not anywhere. Yeah. Like, you're not seeing them in a convenience store in a package. They're just in hospital EMS rooms for us poor bastards that have a choice of either severe hypoglycemia or eat that. And yeah, I'll eat them. I like them.
I one of the flight nurses I work with fucking loves Lorna Dunes. And every time we go to a particular hospital that had been stockpiling those things, it just like fucking reach in and just load up a bag of those things, just excited, you know. And I so I made a video one time on how to properly eat a Lorna Dune, which was I essentially opened it and then dumped it in the garbage. He's also a ultra marathon runner, and so I wanted to take like you have to have snacks at some point on your, like, and you could leave like little drop bags and shit, because he does like the fucking 60 mile runs, like just insane stuff. And I was like, I want to take like, you know, all the like the fucking running food he has and just like switch it out with Lorna Dunes. Like, get that last drop bag where he's like, oh fuck, I'm exhausted. And then all he has is Lorna Dunes. Just
could you
dry
imagine?
Desert cookie.
You get sugar and sand to eat. For any of you guys that have listened to the Medical Stuff podcast, my co-host there, Mark Frankham, and I know I'm going to get a plethora of questions about when's the next episode coming out. Here's the answer. I don't know. Him and I used to, like, these Lorna Dunes would be in the ERs. And every single time Mark would grab one, he would just go, even if it was just to himself. And there's a couple times where I wasn't even, like, present, or at least there's no way he could have known I was present. Like, I was quiet behind him. And he'd just pick it up and silently to himself go, Lorna Dune. Like, just like that every single time. He wouldn't even eat it. He'd pick it up, read the package, go, Lorna Dune, and then put it back. I don't know why, but he would. And so Lorna Dunes hold a special place in my heart. Spence, anything else to add before we shut this down?
No. Hansen, they're back.
Are they
and
really?
They have beer. It's called Hops.
Are you serious? Is this real?
It's a real thing.
Oh, God.
Yeah. No, they're all grown up.
Is it really called Mops? Like, you didn't make
it
that
is.
Up? Oh,
dude,
God.
It's a legit fucking beer that they brew.
My goodness. Okay, so here's one of the things that we are going to do now. Because Hansen's Mbop has become such a staple, as Spencer leads us out on the last, I want to say, two episodes. You did the same thing. Thanks for being creative. But yeah. I think we need to get Hops, and on one of our episodes, we need to try it out for the first time together and record our reactions and then move on into the episode.
Absolutely. I think we should.
Yeah, I think we do. Let's order some hops, make that happen. With that, everybody, thank you once again for listening to EMS 2020. I just realized that I did not do the normal housekeeping at the start of the episode, but that's okay. If you're here, you probably already listened to us anyway. So please follow us on social media if you don't already. It's EMS20/20 on Facebook. And this episode, a lot of the way we did this episode was because of the interactions we get on social media. You can go there. You can see things like EKGs that we post, funny things that we post, questions to you guys that we post. So it's a great way to interact and influence the show. We love it. Also follow us on Instagram at EMS2020show. We can get your emails at EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. Or you can also message us on any of the social media platforms. We get a lot of messages through theirs. So with that, everybody, thanks again for listening to us this week. We'll be back next week as we always are, unless something catastrophic happens, in which case, hey, we'll announce it on our social media, which you can go to at, anyway. But with that, Spencer, awkwardly, bop us on out.
No.
Bop, booby dop, bop, doom bop, booby dop. I'm just gonna cut.
Nice.
I'm just gonna cut in Hanson at this point to say it's me.
Dude, we really should. Fuck, we should.